This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
To the Nichols Family Lawyers podcast. I'm Beck Dahl, a partner at Nichols Family Lawyers. I'm joined by Sally Nichols, our managing partner. Today we are speaking with Joe Ball and Jessica Stopp. Joe is the CEO of Switchboard Victoria. Switchboard is a community-based, not-for-profit organisation that provides support services to the LGBTIQA+ community, their friends, families and allies in Victoria. Some examples of Switchboard's programs include Out and About, a social home visiting service for LGBTIQA+ Victorians at risk of socialisation. Switchboard is also the Victorian partner in the National Telephone and Web Counselling Information and Referral Service QLife. In addition, they run an after-hours telephone support service called With Respect, providing support, information and counselling in relation to family and intimate partner violence. Our second guest, Jessica Stopp, is a service delivery manager at WIRE, the Women's Information Referral Exchange. WIRE is a not-for-profit organisation providing information, support and referral services to women, non-binary and gender-diverse people in Victoria. Their service offering is very broad, including clinics and programs relating to family law, financial literacy and job coaching. Welcome, Joe and Jessica. It's great to have you on our podcast today.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Beck.
Joe, I'll start with you. I probably did a terrible job of introducing Switchboard during my intro, but I'd love for you to tell us a bit about Switchboard and its history and its programs that it offers the LGBTIQA+ community.
Sure, with pleasure. Switchboard is a 29-year-old service, starting in 1991. And one thing that's been at the forefront of my mind recently is that we are a service born of an epidemic. Born of a virus, and that is the HIV/AIDS virus. That was the period that we came out of, and during the early days, a lot of the volunteers that we had were people who themselves had HIV and AIDS. And when I looked back at over the years, I've looked back at the old newsletters, and month by month, you know, there was always obituaries in the newsletters of volunteers who had died. So I think at this time, you know, we're very cognizant of what an epidemic means, what stigmatization means. And also I think we're very much, you know, have it in our, if you'll pardon the pun, but we very much have it in our blood to respond to an epidemic. So, you know, that's part of our history. 29 years on, you know, we started as a telephone service. We now run two different telephone lines. One is a, as you rightly said, a family violence service for LGBTI communities. And the other is the Victorian partner in the National QLife service. We also run a service for elders, and we run a suicide prevention program and a queer and trans intersex people of colour project, which is about tackling racism in our community and addressing the needs of people of colour in our LGBTIQA+ community. What makes us unique is that we're a community-controlled organisation, which means that as well as being an LGBTI specialist organisation, is that we are, everyone who works and volunteers at the organisation identifies as part of the community. So it's our health in our hands, and as I put it, it's community control, which is, you know, very important about empowerment and you know, I guess self-determination around health outcomes.
Joe, you really gave me goosebumps when you talked about the stigma 29 years ago and the AIDS epidemic. And I remember at that time some of the pain and the awful homophobia in the community at that time. And I think now it's a very difficult time for the community as a whole generally, but there must be certain specific mental health issues that are really prevalent that you're seeing at the moment for the LGBTIQ plus community. Could you share that with people at the moment and what Switchboard's doing to try and actually address those issues?
Well, one thing that is, I mean, also it's a very re-traumatizing experience for people who live through HIV. So there's that. There's you know, our predominantly older gay male population, but obviously it's not limited to that, but predominantly. And, you know, for them, it brings back a flood of terrible memories.
No, I can imagine.
So, you know, terrible injustice. And unlike now, during HIV, you know, people did not have the public health response that we have now to COVID-19. And, you know, a lot of people were left on their own, deserted by family and the public health system to cope with the virus. So there's that, you know, the re-traumatisation. And now around family violence, one of the issues is, you know, with the mass unemployment that's taking place at the moment, our community is overrepresented in some of the industries that have, you know, been decimated by COVID-19, and you know, that it's the arts industry and the hospitality industry. You know, that is industries that LGBTI people are overrepresented in. And so there's, you know, an increase in unemployment in our communities, and we've seen a lot of people have to return to, you know, pack up their share houses, which are actually for people more than their share houses, their chosen family, and they've had to return to family of origin. And you know, there's an assumption that family of origin is an open door for people, but often in our community, family of origin comes with a lot of compromise, and returning to that family of origin might be that you can't express your gender or sexuality, or you can't return to that house with your partner, or, you know, or presenting your gender and living your gender the way you want to live it. So there's a lot of pressure around, I guess, families at the moment in our community. So there's that. And then I would say, in addition to that, is social isolation for our, you know, across the board. I mean, everyone's facing social isolation, but I think, you know, if you already have poor mental health outcomes, you know, social isolation compounds that. And in LGBTIQ plus communities, we have a tragically overrepresentation of people who suicide or live with chronic suicidality. And when you're working with suicide, you know, one of the things you want to do is keep people safe for now. And within a COVID-19 context, keeping safe for now is a complex mental health terrain to work in, because people can't necessarily do all the kind of mental health, enact their mental health safety plan. They have to rewrite their mental health safety plan. And, you know, things that might have been keeping them safe, you know, they don't have as much access to, you know, like community groups or face-to-face service provision or that kind of thing. So there's a bit of a cluster of issues there. However, I do want to say one thing as I summarize all that up is that also there's so much resilience in our community, because we are used to tackling issues of, you know, community for us is not always the community you find in your nearest proximity. A lot of people in our community are used to going online and looking for community there, and looking for community across state borders, across national borders. So in some ways, there's actually a lot of capacity in our community to respond. And I think our community responded very quickly and set up a lot of online groups. And of course, you know, we have our own radio station, which, you know, there's a lot of things, a lot of capacity as well. So, you know, there's good and bad.
Joe, what can allies and what can the community do to support those who are most vulnerable at this time?
I think that some of the things is that, you know, I think it's a reiteration of things that allies already know, but is making people aware that, you know, if your services are accessible to members of the LGBTIQA plus community, letting people know that your services are still open. Like, that's been a really big challenge for us, is to get out there to people that things have changed in our service delivery. For example, that we can't physically visit people in residential aged care facilities and in their own homes, but we are virtually visiting. So I think, you know, that's, you know, that's something that people can do. I think that if people, you know, might want to transform the ways that they show that they're an ally, people used to always wear their rainbow lanyards. You can still wear your rainbow lanyards at home. You know, like if you're talking to people and, giving and talks, you can still, you know, represent yourself in that way. I think, you know, it'd be great if people can share our services, make sure that our referral pathways are on your websites, and that you're, you know, including us in the list. Like I've noticed at this time that a lot of people have kind of reverted to what I sort of call as the big guys in the mental health sector, and they list, you know, the people that are doing great work like Lifeline and Beyond Blue, but they drop off, you know, maybe some, you know, some of the other services like Wire, like Panda, like ArcVic, and like us at Switchboard, and just thinking about that, you know, it's not a one size fits all when it comes to mental health. And if, you know, when you're thinking about sharing infographics, to just remember, you know, adding on those other services, because sometimes, you know, people in our LGBTI community don't always have a great experience on Lifeline and Beyond Blue, because, you know, we're a specialist service, and it's good just to create all the options. Some people in our community use those services all the time, but like, it's just about, you know, don't diminish choice during this time when there's no need to. So that's something. And of course, where people can raise up our services, that's really important, in all sorts of ways. Giving a shout out, like what we're doing today, you know, like including us and lifting us up. And of course, donations. But that's, you know, it's a hard time to ask for donations. It really is a hard time to ask for it. But we've definitely seen, as most organisations, you know, are plummeting in donations. Like at Switchboard Victoria, you know, we know that predominantly our donations come from our own community, not so much from people outside our community. It's very much our community. And when you know, go back to that initial point I said about people losing their employment at this time, that flows through to donations and, you know, people who are regular donors not being able to make those contributions. So I guess it's about people just keeping us in frame at this time. Like when you're calling for maybe donations for Beyond Blue, you sort of think, well, they have actually had some significant sort of federal government contributions, which they greatly deserve, don't get me wrong. But no, just don't forget about the small providers as well, who are actually doing some really heavy lifting at this time.
Thanks, Joe. That's great. One thing I wanted to ask you about, and you touched on it before when you were talking about the way you're changing some of your services, is one of the programs that I just loved when I heard about it was your Out and About program. And I wondered whether you could tell us a little bit about that and how you've been able to adapt that during this COVID-19 time.
Yeah, it's always a service really close to my heart as well, because it is a service for elders, you know, and it's very much although when I say that, we also support people with disabilities, but it is set up as an older person service. But we don't turn anyone away. So we do have people in their 50s and beyond, you know, that like, but one of the things about Out and About is, you know, we're still intaking people and we want to get that message out. Actually, just sort of, I pushed that out today on our social media, but that's an important message, is we're absolutely still doing intake. So people should refer people to our services. And you know, at the moment, what we're doing is what we normally would do would match a volunteer with an older person or an LGBTI person with a disability in their home or in an aged care facility, and they would then visit in person, which is a beautiful service. And we do that throughout Victoria, and match volunteers that live in the same kind of location. But we absolutely are visiting people all across Victoria. During this time, we obviously can't have volunteers going into aged care facilities. You know, it's at this point, our older community are particularly at risk. So we very early have stopped our visits. So we haven't been visiting for about 6 weeks in aged care facilities. But what we've been doing is doing everything else, the virtual visiting. We've been getting our volunteers and even some of our staff members to contact people more than ever. Because one of the things we've found is that when you can't just replace a physical visit with a phone call, it's actually just not the same. So we've had to really visualize that instead of someone getting visited once a week, is that they're being called numerous times a week to be checked in on. And that's been and so we've been trying to do Skype and, you know, all the different devices where we can, and call them, letter writing, you know, there's been huge amounts of challenges in this area, because I think there's a lot of assumptions about how older people live. And, you know, there's technology challenges, but there's also poverty challenges. Not every person actually has a mobile phone, and I think we often forget that. And when some people live in residential aged care facilities, they're sharing communal phones. So that's, you know, a big challenge we've had to do. We've been trying to get devices into people, train people in devices. And in addition to all that kind of challenge, which I must say we've had no additional funds to do, but we have had some fantastic donations to do it, is that we've also sent out care packages to every single person who's in our service. Because we've just known that people really need to receive something from us, because it is a very scary time. And what we've realised is, you know, 1/3 of the people that we support have dementia, and a lot of our older people have been very scared about what it means where they're being told by the people physically closest to them in aged care facilities they can't go outside, because it seems a lot like abuse. So what role we've played is in conveying to those older people that actually they're hearing it from us, that there is a virus going around and they do need to stay in and they do need to listen to that kind of advice. And we, you know, because you can't, it's often it's very important where this messaging comes from. You know, the messenger can be just as important as the message. So we've played that role for our older people, is keeping them up to date through these care packages we've been sending them, through letters we've been sending them, and for those who can read emails, through emails to say, actually, there is something going on. You do need to follow these health warnings and stay safe at this time.
Thanks, Joe. That's great. And it's so great to hear that those services are still helping older people who are isolated. Jess, I might bring you in now and ask about how things are at WIRE in terms of what your observations are about the sort of support that older people have been looking for through WIRE at the moment.
Thanks, Bec. Certainly, as Joe has been talking quite a lot about as well, there's an increased need for social connection, and that goes for all people calling WIRE, but particularly for old people as they, because of the COVID restrictions, are quite likely not to have as many people able to visit them. I think also the feeling of uncertainty and living in such a period of unknown is incredibly stressful for people. And I've certainly noticed that as a really significant additional pressure. And I think for a lot of people, if they're already living in situations where they are under pressure and their mental health is under pressure, the introduction of so much uncertainty and lack of access to the usual things that support them can be quite unbearable for people. And we've certainly noticed an increase in suicidality as well, and a real sort of sense of desperation and not knowing what to do next.
I was just going to say, Jess, Joe spoke before about how switchboards change their out and about program to make sure that people are still getting that service. I know at WIRE, you've done some similar things with your programs as well.
At WIRE, we have a program called the Amica program, which is a lunch and activities club for women, non-binary and gender diverse people who are experiencing either housing security or social isolation or both. Usually they meet up face to face and go on excursions and have lunch together. But during this period of social distancing, we've been providing the program as a social connection phone calls twice a week. So if people are interested in this, they're very welcome to contact WIRE on the phone support line, which is 1300 134 130, and say that they would like to find out about the Amica program, and they could receive a phone call from a support worker one or two times a week to just bring them back to feeling more socially connected. Also, as part of this program, we're exploring food delivery options. As I said, it's usually a lunch program, and there are places like Lentil, if anything, are offering delivery of food. So we're hoping to be able to continue with some of the lunch part of the program as well.
That's so great, Jess, and it's so great to hear how services like Wire and Switchboard are adjusting to be able to keep providing that support. Have you seen any increase in older people and the challenges they face around family violence at the moment?
I think there are definitely added pressures. There's a real sense that the options to get away are not the same at the moment. And I think that elder abuse is a really interesting form of abuse in that it doesn't fit the model of family violence that we would expect, and that can make it less visible. So it's often not in an intimate partnership and often with other family relationships. So elder abuse, we see a lot of elder abuse which is coming from adult children perpetrated towards the elderly parent. So it breaks down the heteronormative stereotypes of family violence as well. In addition to that, we've seen examples recently of elderly people being abused and harassed and stalked by people in their own neighbourhood. And this is really difficult because this is a time where we don't have a lot of places to go. So we're finding that we're all going down to the same local park. And if you're going down to the park and there's someone there from your street who's harassing you, or you think that they might be there, that takes away that safe option of getting out and exercising and having a change of scenery. So yeah, I think it's just a weird and wonderful variations on abuse and violence that are happening at this time.
And Jo, what type of abuse have you been seeing in terms of this strange time?
One of the things we've been really cognizant of is that the role we often play in our visiting program is often an eyes on to abuse. And that's something we haven't been able to do. You know, like there's something, and something I've always felt really passionate about is, you know, there's always a neoliberal pressure on, like, you know, doing these kind of visits over the phone. Like, because it's, you know, meaning that it's often cheaper, but I've always fought to have our service face to face because so much is picked up face to face. You know, just that going into someone's house and seeing, are they coping? And one of the things we do pick up is elder abuse because we, you know, that by being around and definitely abuse in care, we've picked up by actually going in and doing visits. And so something that's cognizant to me is we don't have that eyes on at the moment. And I think there'll be lots of, you know, unpacking after this about what people have gone through that we haven't been able to intervene on. Like one of the things we've found is that, you know, people not have, you know, our older trans community not having access to the clothes that they want to wear, like money not being released to them through either family or guardianship to buy the particular gender clothes they want to wear. And that's something we've been able to pick up by going in there, you know, by going in and seeing people in their houses and finding that they actually have, you know, why are they in their pajamas all day? Because they actually don't have clothes to wear. And, you know, that's actually, a live case that we experienced. So I think that, you know, that's something that's really big for me is that eyes on. The other thing is that a lot in our community, a lot of people, across our community, but definitely in our trans and gender diverse community and in our older community, are quite scared to go out because people are, you know, there's been a number of cases of people in the aggravation in the grocery store, in the supermarkets, often, you know, comes out in forms of bigotry. And we know that that's the case with racism. We've often, you know, there's been numerous cases of people of Chinese ethnicity being targeted for racism.
Yes.
That members of our trans and gender diverse community have been targeted for, you know, people's aggravations and frustrations in the stores. So what we've had is some of our older people being afraid to go out, afraid that they're going to be, you know, on the end of that aggression. And that's a food scarcity issue that if people are not going out and buying food so that they can eat, you know, that's actually a concern, like let alone whether there's food on the shelves. If people don't feel like they can go out and do the purchasing of the food, that's a real, real worry. And then that's compounded by people in our transgender diverse community concerned about accessing things like Woolworths online or food delivery, because they're concerned about, you know, well, again, that's more strangers, more people I don't know, finding out where I live, you know, coming into my home. So there's a lot of, I would say, a lot of anxiety and fear. And there's been a number of cases of people being like dobbed in for being outside their house. And I think that some of this, you know, like dobbing into the police, sometimes, you know, people use that as a bit of a vindictive approach.
Yes.
You know, like if you don't like the older trans woman on your street already because you've got some bigoted opinions, you know, there is, you know, we're hearing reports of people, you know, dobbing in people they don't like to the police for leaving their house. And I think, you know, that's not great. Obviously, that's awful that people are doing that. And then that's just making our older people just so concerned and so worried about, you know, about being out there. And, you know, and it's within a population who are historically scared of the police. So it's sort of, you know, it's again that re-traumatizing, that historical re-traumatizing of people experiencing again that effect of being targeted.
Joe and Jess, I wanted to ask both of you, if I was concerned about an older person in my life or in my community, what would you recommend that I could do, I guess, myself to access some help or assistance for them?
If they're an older LGBTI person and they're socially isolated, I think, you know, really important to hook them into our Out and About program and refer them. I think that, you know, a lot of the support, because once they're in our program, the thing is we don't just visit them, we offer them referrals and support. And, you know, we offer them, you know, a level of case management when they enter our service, in the sense that we're checking in on them and making sure that they have access and knowledge of a range of services. And there's a lot of warm referrals going on. So for LGBTIQA+ people, older people, you know, if they fit the demographics, you know, and of the Out and About program, then I would say absolutely refer them in. And also remind them that they can call, you know, our phone service as well, that it's not just our Out and About program, but it's actually, you know, our two different telephone services, our With Respect line and Key Life, and that they are open every single day.
Anyone concerned about someone in their community is welcome to call WIRE. The way that we regard those calls is that we would encourage the person themselves to call us so that we can really explore what's happening for them and what their priorities are and what their options are. The model of support that we use is an empowerment model, and it's essential that it's centered on the person who's needing the help. But we would also support the person calling on behalf of the other person as well, recognizing that supporting someone and feeling concerned about someone can be a really heavy load as well. And we could explore options for them to have ongoing support too. So as WIRE supports women, non-binary and gender diverse people, you could call on behalf of someone meeting that eligibility criteria, or if you meet it yourself, you can call on behalf of anyone else. So it's quite broad.
Yeah, that's great. Because I think that, you know, it might be that we're seeing things, as Joe mentioned earlier, you know, when you've got your eyes on someone, it might be that, you know, at the moment, everyone's a bit more alert to what's going on with their neighbours and community. And it's good to know that we have options like WIRE and like Switchboard if people do need that support.
And we would be really looking to hear what was happening for people in their own words. I really relate to what you're saying, Joe, about not being able to see what's happening for someone can really sort of limit their access to support, and a lot of abuse could become quite invisible. And just being able to unpack with someone and recognising that older people may have different language around violence. They might not use the word violence. They might not even use the word abuse. But if they're using the word scared or uncomfortable, we can unpack those things. So it's really important. The model of understanding people's stories from their own perspective becomes incredibly important at this time. And like you, Joe, I've just noticed the incredible resilience and resourcefulness of the people who we've been speaking to. People who have been marginalized and who have had to think outside of the box in terms of how to keep themselves safe and access support are really, that's really showing up at the moment. And it's so incredibly impressive. And one of the things that we've noticed a lot of during this time is just the gratitude that people have about being listened to and feeling as though their story and their situation has been truly heard and understood.
One of the things that I was recounting the other day was the elder abuse panel that you were both involved in, I believe, and I remember Julie Kuhn, who's the CEO of Y, was facilitating, and Joe was certainly speaking at quite passionately about elder abuse last year. And we had one of the community police speaking about the training that was going on, the specialist training for elder abuse, and they really were training police to actually go into homes and were quite centred on the fact that there will often be a carer present when police are interviewing an elderly person who might actually be the perpetrator, and that the police were being trained to look for signs and indirect signs of abuse because the carer might be present who is actually the perpetrator. So I can imagine, again, another layer to difficulty, but again, something to mention that there are specialist now groups being trained within the police force. And we would like to be able to mention at the end of this podcast, we will be providing online links to that community policing specialist branches, as well as to Switchboard and Wire beneath these podcasts. So if there are concerns, that listeners can actually go to those links. I think that's really important because I think the police are attempting to develop that specialist training when they do actually go out to those sorts of calls.
Yeah, and I've been engaged with the police about recognising, you know, I've been part of their training modules speaking about identifying LGBTIQA+ family violence, because I guess, and I really heard that with you, Jessica, about like when you were saying, you know, people, you've got to sort of critically really listen to what people are saying, because people don't always have the words for family violence. And that's definitely the case in our community, because the mainstream story about family violence is men's violence against women. And in our community, that's not always the case. Sometimes that is the case, but it's often not. And so, you know, there's a real story about that, you know, that two lesbians don't necessarily recognize that they could be in a family violence situation, that one of them could be a victim and one of them could be a perpetrator. And we also see, you know, gender stereotypes play out in our community in the sense that the perpetrator is often recognized as the more masculine person. And that's not always the case. That's, you know, and I think that is that overlay of the mainstream story about men's violence against women, which is really important, but also the violence in our community, which our community makes up 15 to 20% of the population. You know, we have another story to say about family violence. And the story is about power and control, and is absolutely a very similar story, but it's a different gendered story. And I've had those conversations with many feminist organizations. And I think that a lot of organizations are actually, and I know Wire is definitely, you know, coming, you know, is looking into this and is across it. And I think more and more feminist organizations are starting to engage with what LGBTIQA+ family violence looks like. And that's really, really, really important. And, you know, a component of that is definitely for trans and gender diverse people and within the family violence circumstances, that a lot of the time we have felt that how people are treated as transgender is something that we might deserve or that we asked for by being the identities that we are. And, you know, we're starting to come out of that and say, actually, we deserve not to be the victims of abuse just because you're somebody who was assigned male at birth, and you, when you go out into the world, you wear women's clothing because you are a woman. That doesn't mean that you should be bashed in the street. You know, we need to change that story. That's a huge story about you know, about violence, and not only just in the street, that also happens in intimate partner relationships where people are bashed as well in those circumstances. So yeah, I think that and that's another thing with elder abuse as well. Like that plays into that absolutely, is that an older LGBTI people, you know, also don't deserve to be humiliated, abused by their children just because, you know, their children may not agree with their gender or sexuality. You know, at any age we deserve to, you know, live the lives and live the genders and sexualities that we are without persecution and violence.
Absolutely. And it's great to hear that the police are getting more training. From a Y perspective, we would really encourage anyone concerned about someone else to get them to call a service themselves before exploring any options of calling police. Because as we're talking about, that there can be discrimination that happens from the police as well. And having police involved for many people isn't going to be the safest option.
That's such good advice from both of you. It's really good to understand, you know, what options there are and what we can do to help some of the older people and other people who are struggling in our community at the moment.
Yeah, I never forget Joe commenting on one form of abuse being the restraining and refusal to give medication to some of the elderly transgender. And that was one of the most heart-rendering comments that you made, Joe, that just the removal of medication and the impact that would actually have on an elderly transgender person. I think you might have even said that one elderly transgender person had a heart attack as a result of that medication being taken away too early.
Yeah, I could have said that at that time. You know, the access to medication, you know, it unfortunately it remains a public debate, and that's terrible. It's not a public debate within the medical circles or health circles, but it's still a political football. However, I absolutely welcome I welcome what Greg Hunt, the health has said in just this last week about, you know, not entering into an inquiry anymore about transgender medication and hormone treatment, you know, and canning that inquiry, which I think
is wonderful. That wasn't it.
Yeah, it's so welcome. And I think, you know, I think that sometimes with these public emergencies, like this epidemic, this pandemic that we're in, is we actually get to reevaluate what are the real social ills. You know, and the real social ills here are quite clearly, obviously, the virus, but then poverty, you know, and the consequences of, like, you know, a pandemic and poverty and family violence and these contributors. Transgender people accessing hormones is not a public health emergency. And that's what this moment and the minister has confirmed, is that, you know, people should have a right to be the people they want to be, and that's just not a priority. That political football has been kicked out of the park, and hopefully will continue to be. Yes.
An inquiry would just further stigmatise vulnerable people. It would just be cruel.
Yeah, and it just shows it for what it was. You know, like they were saying, oh, this is an emergency about access to hormones. You know, we need to review it. But when the impetus has gone for there to be a political football to do political scoring, when that impetus is gone, you realise that it is just the trumped up inquiry that it was, which was just to stigmatise people in order to, you know, pit people against each other. And I just cannot only welcome that so much, because at the moment we just need to be focusing on real public health concerns and real social policy solutions.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.